the Joint Ways and Means to order and open the public hearing for House Bill, Senate Bill 5546. Mr. Siebert, do you have anything to add?
Just very briefly, at your places you'll find responses from the department to questions from yesterday. But I'm sure the department will go over quickly with you if you would like to begin the hearing.
We would like. Okay. Cleary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cleary, Director of the Water Resource Department. What we've got is we've got some of the material that will respond in writing to you here, and then the rest we're going to cover in our various testimony and explanations, so you can kind of use this as a check sheet to make sure that we cover all the things that we indicate in here, and you'll see where we've got a name on the outside, and when we get into Dick or Tom or Barry's areas, we'll make sure that we cover those different things, and I'll keep track of it here on the scorecard as well. But you had requested several larger scale maps, and the first one that we've got in there is the adjudicated areas within Oregon. Anything that's in color has been adjudicated. The different colors just are there to try to separate out the different basins. And you'll see, like down the Klamath, what's in the crosshatch is the area that's currently in the Klamath adjudication. But there are portions of that basin that have been adjudicated before, down in that small or in the southwest corner there, southeast corner is the Lost River Basin, and that's an area that's been adjudicated. That kind of mustard color right next to the word Klamath is the Wood River Valley, and that's an area that's been adjudicated. Once the rest of the basin gets adjudicated, then those rights will be integrated into the overall priority system for that basin. So we just wanted to show that to you. And maybe with that, Mr. Chair, unless there's questions, we'll start right in with Dick Bailey's area, and we'll kind of interleaf back and forth.
I want to, on behalf of Representative Krieger, the elder of the committee, thank you for the larger.
We'll work our way through. Okay, thank you. We'll just go ahead here. Dick, why don't you take the
center stage there. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dick Bailey. I'm the Administrator of Water Rights Adjudication Division for the Water Resources Department. I would refer you to page 47 of the blue binder and budget summary, and also to page 262 of the budget document if you're looking at that in regard to the Water Rights Adjudication Division.
Excuse me, what was your first page number again?
Tab 3, page 47, right behind there. As you can see from the introductory page, the Water Rights Adjudication Division's accomplished several diverse functions, including those listed on page 47. And with your permission, I'd like to walk through those briefly and some statistics that are behind those pages. Starting with the water rights section, this is, work section is comprised of 5 caseworkers, 2 support staff, and 1 protest coordinator. The unit evaluates water rights applications, issues permits, and coordinates with other state agencies where there's a broader application in regard to a permit application. Water rights statistics for what we do in the water rights section are found on pages 52 through 55, and I'll walk through those just briefly. Starting on page 52, in the first graph, water rights application activity, you will note that for the first time in several years, the department has been successful in issuing significantly more final orders than applications received, thus reducing a pending backlog. Also worthy of note is the number for the year 2001. This was a drought year, and the department issued 95 drought permits. Many of these drought permits were then followed by regular permit applications. The question was asked yesterday, I believe, what will the graph look like at the end of 2005? The answer depends in part upon the fate of House Bill 2268, which I'll speak to in a moment. History's taught us that when we experience a spike, experience a spike in applications just prior to a fee increase, we will then experience a decline immediately thereafter, and then over the subsequent years, we'll see a leveling out. However, we will also note that climatic conditions, the general economy will also have some other impact. In drought years, we'll see that the drought permits require the use of staff to administer the drought permits, thus taking them away from working on other water right applications, and consequently we see some growth in the backlog of other water right applications. The general economy relative to individual farming and ranching incomes has an impact. Because as these incomes go up and down, we see a variation in how much new acreage is put into production and consequently the requirement for new water rights. And lastly, as water becomes more scarce, the applications become more complex, takes more time to work on them. We try to work out with people how best to meet their needs. That takes more time and effort. The likelihood then is that protests will go up and associated legal costs increase. That said, and it's difficult any time to make a projection because you might get held to it and you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we project that we'll see a decrease in the backlog over the next biennium of 10 to 15%. That's because of the statutory process we use. We will always see a certain amount of applications in the queue. Each application requires three specific actions. Those actions times X number of applications per month over a 240-day period are going to give you kind of the number that we will always have in the queue. So when you see 400, 500, or 600 in the queue, that's probably the way it should be, and it's not necessarily bad. Relative to our water rights processing, the department has policy package number 160. Which proposes fee adjustments to address existing workloads and increasing demands. The increase is proposed under House Bill 2268, and the proposed fees would generate between $1.2 and $2 million over the entirety of the next biennium. These fees also support policy packages number 131, 132, and 143, found on subsequent pages and other divisions. With that, I'll move along to certificates. In the certificate workload chart on the bottom of page 52, you'll notice that since the legislature provided additional resources to the department for work on certificates backlog in 2001, the workload has decreased dramatically. Although the pace of reduction is slowing due to more complicated cases now being addressed, we've been successful in addressing the needs of all permit holders who are in need of a certificate for purposes of transfer or property transaction. We began with essentially two-thirds new staff to work on certificates. We had to train them up. We took the easiest ones first. We batched the smaller ones, and we were able to decrease the workload by over 2,000 certificates. We now have a trained staff. We're moving ahead. But now we're also getting into the more complicated claims of beneficial use, and they do take more time.
Mr. Bailey, what is the average, maybe, or the extreme times that people have to wait to get their certificate?
We have certificates that have been in the door for 10 or 12, or requests for certificates, claims of beneficial use, been in the door for 10 or 12 years. Some of these are very complex and require additional work that may take a person reviewing that particular case a month or more, and site visits and the like. In those cases, we've had conversations with many of these permit holders. These people are not disadvantaged by not having a certificate in hand. They can continue to use the water under the permit. They are the only time they may be disadvantaged is if someone perceives the value of their property to be less as a result of not having the certificate, in which case we will usually move that particular request to the top of the queue so that nobody is, in fact, disadvantaged.
And if they're at the top of the queue, is that, I guess that depends on the complexity of the request, too.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The first priority would be to make sure that the permit holder is not disadvantaged, irregardless of the complexity of the claim that is in front of us. Yesterday, I believe Representative Morgan asked whether or not there are some decreed rights that have not received certificates. And that's true. There is, in one case, the Lost River Supplemental Adjudication has been decreed, but no certificates issued. We have completed the development of the certificates per the decree, but the issuance of those has been stayed by legal action. So they're in a drawer. Also, it was asked if we could guess what the workload would look like in 2005. Our best guess, based upon the permits that will be due for certificates in that year, the current backlog, the complexity of the permits ready for certificates, and staff available to work on them, is that we will probably end 2005 with about 5,000 permits needing certificates. I would fudge that a little by saying plus or minus a few percentage points, but we believe it's going to be about 5,000.
We just hope you can get it closer than the revenue projections we've been dealing with here lately.
Okay. The charts on page 53 depict water right applications by type and water right applications by use, and they're pretty much self-explanatory. On page 54, on the chart for approval rate by type, it should be noted that the numbers for large reservoirs are essentially statistically insignificant in that there were only 11 applications and 3 of those were denied. In regard to surface water applications, approximately 19% of those applications were denied, with the major reason being there was simply not water available within our water availability model. Also on page 54 is the chart for current status of water right applications and protests. At the end of February of this year is when we took this snapshot, and it is somewhat fluid. Noteworthy is the 264 applications that were on administrative hold. Now, administrative hold is a mechanism used by applicants which provides time to resolve deficiencies and also to work with the department to work out alternative approaches when they may not be able to meet all their needs of the original application. And it gives us an opportunity to work with them, their consultants, and others to see if we can reach a potential yes for them. The last chart is on page 55.
Let me go back to page 54 for a second.
Okay.
My guess is that you're seeing a growing number of applicants that are using consultants to get through the process. Do you have a number as to what percentage the landowners do it themselves and what percentage they're hiring consultants to whether it's water right or transfer or whatever?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a number for you. We do believe that it's a growing number, but it's probably not more consultants, it's more attorneys.
That's even worse yet. Expense-wise.
I knew you weren't going to be able to let that one slide.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the last chart's on 55. This explains the status of protests which have been filed and then resolved. Noteworthy here is the success of our alternative dispute resolution program, where the department representatives have successfully negotiated resolution between the applicants, department, and other agencies, such as third-party protestants. It's been asked, you know, where do most of these protests come from? 77% come from the applicant themselves. They simply didn't get what they wanted. They've protested. Then we go into the ADR program and see if we can work with the applicant and in most cases we are successful in doing that. 9% of the protests come from interest groups such as environmental groups and the like. But 23% come mostly from concerned neighbors who have a concern that they would be adversely impacted by the proposed water use. Many times, however, I need to point out that we don't need a formal protest to resolve a conflict. I remember a case that was in Representative Johnson's district where we proposed denying, we had a PFO, proposed final order denying an application. The applicants called our water rights section manager and said, I don't understand this. Together they were able to sit down, work it over, and find out that there was a misapplication of some rules, and we were able to resolve the conflict. That happens a lot, where people simply have a question and we can resolve it based upon that, as long as there's the free exchange and a good dialogue between us and our constituents. Moving on to limited licenses, we allocate one FTE to the issuance of limited licenses. Limited licenses are short-term authorizations for water use and are only available when the water master can find that there is actually water available in real time. These are often used for construction projects, road watering, the establishment of a crop for which future irrigation will not be needed, like a vineyard, and to carry on what is otherwise a illegal use under an enforcement order so that the person can work through the applications process and become legitimized. Permit extensions. This is another unit with only one FTE. There are currently 316 extensions pending. Each of these extensions requests that the department extend the permit development time. And because of recent rulemaking, which included many of our stakeholders, this rulemaking caused many municipal applications to be placed on hold while the rules were finished, while we finished developing the rules. The rules are finished now. We're in the process of working through these extension requests. I know the next area is of interest to you, which is customer service. It's an area where we provide a lot of emphasis. In our division, customer service is everyone's business. In correspondence with applicants, the name and phone number of the person working on their application is clearly noted, and they are told that that person is made available for direct contact in regard to their application. There's always time made to communicate effectively and efficiently with applicants. In addition to making customer service the business of all of our division members, we have two FTE that are allocated to a group we call the Water Right Information Group. These people man the counter, provide direct information that people want to obtain other than through our website. They are folks who do additional research when that information isn't readily available. And they get a lot of praise from the public generally. And we do track our customer service, but we track it informally. Yesterday, the director noted that the division keeps track of complaint-free days. We're up to about 196 right now, sequential complaint-free days. And what a complaint is, by our definition, is when somebody comes to a supervisor and said, I was treated improperly by one of your employees, or I didn't get a timely answer, or I didn't get a phone call back, that type of thing. We don't count complaints as, I didn't get the amount of water I wanted, because that's beyond our discretion in many cases. But it is an area that we put a lot of emphasis on, and we do track.
Let me ask you, do we have a graph or anything here that shows the field staff and what's happened in your numbers there over the last few years? I'm sure you've been reducing staff.
Right. Mr. Chair, we've got in here, well, we had the graph of the overall staff reductions within the agency, and we've got information when we get into the field services division on where some of the vacancies that have occurred and are scheduled for elimination in the balanced budget, where that would impact. I think we've got a when we get into the discussion tomorrow, you'd asked us to try to break down what's happened under the governor's balance reduction, and then another five and another five, and we've got that with staff numbers by different divisions as well, so that'll help give you that.
That's in the future. I'm looking at for some
the historic numbers,
history of what we've been over the last five
right,
or 10 years.
And maybe Tom can think some on that while he's here and give you something informally, and we can give you more detail on that.
Because the staff you were just talking about, you're talking about Salem.
Right, his water right. Divisions all focused in Salem. Uses information from field services folks, but we don't have any water rights specialists out.
That's correct. I would point out, however, that customer service is kind of an integrated function across the department. There is customer service functions going on in each of the regional offices, and if it gets beyond what records are available there, then it comes to us as well. But it is across the entire department and in the field as well. The policy program area has three FTE in it, myself, our manager of the water rights section, and a support person who also supports other portions of the division. These two management positions supervise all functions of the division with a span of control of a little over 11-1. The next section deals with the adjudication section. As you're aware, the department's actively engaged in the Klamath Basin adjudication. To this effort, we've dedicated two FTE, and this is down from the seven that we had in 1997. The adjudication is moving along really rapidly, contrary to some things you hear. We have...
What's the scale here?
Yeah. When I say moving along rapidly, I'm thinking a snapshot at really where we are today. As the director told you yesterday, the adjudication started in 1975, was delayed by two major federal pieces of litigation. Since we took the last claims in 97, we've been hustling right along. In the last biennium, of the 5,656 contests to claims that were filed, we have resolved 76%, or 4,321 of those contests. Not all of them obviously went to contested case hearing. Most of them were settled outside through stipulations of various types. The staff is actively working with our federal partners and with environmental groups and claimants to resolve these in as broad manner as possible and as quickly as possible. We have policy package number 161, which proposes $419,000 from general funds and $300,000 of limitation for federal funds to continue this adjudication. It's important to note that the completion of the Klamath adjudication will provide surety of water rights for the users of the basin, and additionally will provide the water management tools so necessary to manage the water of the basin effectively and efficiently. Without this policy package, on the adjudication, it's going to slow to a crawl. Yesterday, Representative Krieger asked when we might expect to complete the Klamath adjudication. If all things continue as currently planned and policy package number 161 is approved, we estimate submitting an order of determination to the Klamath Circuit Court in 3 years. Additionally, a question was asked in regard to surface water registrations, somewhat related to adjudications. Surface water registrations are a product of ORS 539-230, and I think they can best be characterized as a placeholder or a somewhat like a notice of intent to file a claim in an adjudication. It's anticipated that the surface water registration will become a claim. But in the interim, the department regulates neither for or against a surface water registrant. Therefore, they are not at disadvantage by not having the adjudication go forward immediately. There are some who would argue otherwise because many of the surface water registrants paid a fee, had a CWRE or other professional surveyor develop a map and submit their surface water registration. They may have invested quite a bit of money in doing that, and they've not seen something in return for that money. On the other hand, there are many of those surface water registrants that are getting quite old, and the history of the claim is disappearing. We have encouraged, where people have questioned this, we've encouraged people to develop a record. There's a term for it, but it's kind of like taking a deposition before you die, you know, so that everything is put on the record, so that at some point in the future, if and when an adjudication of that particular basin or sub-basin occurs, the record will have been preserved. We currently have 642 surface water registrations on file in multiple counties. And that's kind of that for the last part is hydroelectric licensing.
What page are we on here, Mr. Barrett?
We're still on the bottom of page 47. Without a doubt, hydroelectric licensing is the fastest growing program in our division. We've allocated 3 permanent and 1 limited duration position to this program. The program is fully funded with other funds. These funds come from annual fees paid by utilities and application fees where we're reimbursed for our work by the utilities that are undergoing reauthorization of their projects. The Water Resources Department has been statutorily designated as the coordinating agency for the development of a unified state position relative to all relicensing. This is most important in relicensing before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I think because these projects were licensed 50 years ago for the most part, and thinking about environmental influences and impacts has evolved over those 50 years significantly, these have become really big deals. And the settlement negotiations that go into the license renewal or into settlement discussions take a long time and are very time-consuming for staff. There isn't a single environmental issue that I think you can think of that isn't involved in a hydro licensing somewhere. And in these relicensing, we partner up with DEQ, ODF&W, our federal partners, and the Fishery Services, the Forest Service, BLM. You just name them, and they're all there. We also have many new applications that are coming in for small, what I consider small compared to, say, Pelton or the Columbia River type projects. These are small projects with maybe a dozen megawatt production capacity. Those have the same kind of time sinks associated with them as the big ones do, because the same influencers are there, although in kind of a micro scale.
Let me ask you, there's two types of licensing, isn't there? There's the FERC licensing plus the state licensing?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Could you relate to us our involvement, the state's involvement in each?
We're involved in both. The FERC licenses, these are projects that where power is put onto the grid, sold at profit, and is regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. These projects are also required to have a state water right. So we're involved there consistently through the whole 5-year application process. The smaller projects that are either FERC exempt or they're not large enough to be licensed by FERC are given a water right by the state. Those projects are usually what we refer to them as mom and pop operations, where they can't get other power or where they want to just use power for a summer home and those types of things. But our involvement is essentially the same. We're looking at the same kind of impacts over a period of time.
Could you tell us a little bit about what other agencies you work with and how you coordinate, since you're the lead agency on the relicensing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we established what's called a HART team, a Hydroelectric Application Review Team. Statutorily, there are three agencies that are required to be a part of that: Water Resources, Environmental Quality, and Fish and Wildlife. Other agencies that may have a concern with that particular license are also a part of that HART. For example, Pelton, which is owned by PGE, we find significant involvement by Parks and Recreation and also by Historical Preservation Office. I'm trying to think who else might. Dogami is also involved in that. Our staff does the coordination of the meetings, sets up the agendas, works with the applicant, makes sure that all the studies are in on time, that the agencies are providing the applicant with the materials that they need so that they can respond to our desires for information. We put out four documents over the length of the discussions that we have: a draft provisional position, a provisional position, a second unified state position, and a final unified state position. In going through those iterations, we attempt to resolve all conflicts between the applicant and the state and between agencies within the state. We have completed a final unified state position on two projects, one being Pelton Round Butte and the other being the North Umpqua Hydro Project by PacifiCorp. The Pelton project is experiencing some difficulties with our federal partner, and we're back into settlement discussions beyond our unified state position. As to how we coordinate, we have a rather aggressive hydro coordinator who just stays on task. The process is not clearly laid out in rule or statute. So we develop partnerships along the way and make people feel comfortable, and where we have to, we help them feel uncomfortable until the work's done.
How many Columbia River dams are currently up for reauthorization?
We, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we don't relicense the Columbia River dams. The federal projects don't come under the authority of the state.
You have input?
We do have an opportunity to provide input, although that's minimal. The projects that we have are, for most part, those within within the state boundaries, although we are currently working on the Idaho Power's Hells Canyon Complex, which is a bi-state project, as is the Klamath, which is a bi-state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gates, the federal projects don't require a state water right, state water authorization, but DEQ and Fish and Wildlife are certainly involved in their operations plan. They have to prepare, you know, the Columbia Basin system prepares an operations plan. They go through a biological opinion, biological consultation. But much like Corps of Engineer projects, and you know that from the removal fill, they have a way of exempting themselves from state jurisdiction, other than from a consultation standpoint.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a follow-up on that. How many applications do you have in for hydroelectric certification, and how many have we completed? I know there was, as I recall from last time I served on this committee, there was quite a group of them that were going to be coming in the next 5-10 years.
Mr. Chair, we currently have 28 reauthorizations pending, and we have new hydro project applications pending of 23.
Let me also ask you, is the Office of Energy or PUC, are they involved in your relicensing process too?
Mr. Chair, PUC has been actively involved where we've been able to use their offices for like technical computations. They have to be very, very careful because part of these mitigation costs for some of these relicensings may be rate-based, so they have two separate processes. So they're more there for advice and consent, and they do participate in the HART. Energy to a much lesser extent because these are not new sightings. They do become involved for the new applications. They do tell us whether or not they want to be involved.
Thank you.
Lastly, I would refer you to page 51. These are our successes. These are things that we're very, very proud of over the last biennium. Our ability to issue 95 drought permits for water use. While not accepting, well, we accepted fees, but we turned around and gave it back. And do this while still decreasing pending water right application backlog. As I pointed out, we resolved more than 76% of the contests filed in the Klamath adjudication. And we coordinated the state's role in reaching settlement on the North Umpqua Hydro Project, which was a long and lengthy process. We achieved a 97% success rate in the resolution of protests. We reduced the certificates backlog by 29%. We streamlined the water rights application review process and consequently reduced the number of pending actions by more than 43%. We coordinated the state's participation in a successful settlement agreement for the decommissioning and removal of Marmot and the Little Sandy Dams. And we provided continuing education opportunities for certified water rights examiners, which over the last several years has reduced the number of claims of beneficial use which didn't meet the standards of the department from 59% to 28%. And we provided a user-friendly weekly public notice and other information through electronic mail, resulting in wider distribution, more timely notice, and at less cost. With that, I'll certainly take any questions you may have.
Okay. Questions from the committee? We'll move to the Field Services Division.
Keep going. We're on a run.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Paul. I'm the Administrator of Field Services Division. And I believe if you turn to page 57 in the blue notebook, you'll find the narrative portion of that. Field Services Division is largely the field portion of the agency. We do have the state divided into five regions. We have a total of 20 water masters spread out around those five regions. In addition to the water masters, we have staff that measure stream flow, inspect wells, and assist with processing water right transfers, providing information to customers, and also providing information and data to watershed councils.
Mr. Paul, let me interrupt you for just a second. I noticed yesterday when we saw a map, I think Mr. Clary presented us of where those districts are. The southwestern Oregon district runs from the Rogue Valley clear to the coast, and it struck me as kind of odd because there's not a good way to get from the upper Rogue to the Gold Beach area, as an example. Or Chetco or any of those. Does that make a lot of sense?
Mr. Chair, we do have some travel issues in a number of our districts, but with the limited number of staff that we have, we try to place the water master offices, for example, in areas that we can more easily get to some of the locations. Like you're aware of the Coquille office down in your area, and that office covers that central or the southern coastal portions of the region.
It wouldn't be as hard if they could just walk through the burn.
If the fire is not active.
In addition to our state field staff, we rely very heavily on locally funded staff to accomplish water management in the local area. We have had nearly 50 locally funded staff in years past. I think currently we're in the mid-30s, and that includes assistant water masters, hydrographic technicians, and clerical support.
Ms. Paulette, let me clarify before we get too far away. So what you've just told me is that the Coquille office services the coastal region of that southern district?
Mr. Chair, the Coquille office, yes, and I think I know where you're going. that position. I think we're looking at eliminating as part of our budget reduction program. No, the Coquiel office.
Good luck.
He said no and he smiled. You heard what he said.
The Coquiel office covers Coos and Curry counties. We have a water master in that office. We also have 1.5 staff that are locally funded. One of those is a clerical position. The other is a hydrographic tech position that is used to measure stream flow. But that office does cover. It's supervised out of the Grants Pass office. But the day-to-day activity, regulation, operations, and all are worked out of the Coquiel office for that coastal portion.
But they are in separate districts, though.
They're in the same region. It's a different water master district.
But I didn't read the map properly. I thought Coos County was in a separate district from Curry County.
Mr. Chair, we have in the southwest region, we have a water master district that is in Jackson County around the Medford area. We have another water master district that is in Josephine County, which is kind of the mid-road portion. We have another water master district, which is in Roseburg, which is the Umpqua drainage, and then we have the fourth water master district, which is in Coquiel for the coastal portions.
I understand.
Mr. Chair, maybe where some of the confusion is coming from, the map that we had yesterday was the map of the appointment districts for the Water Resource Commission, but it's not the same as our regional office map. That's
where
the southwest region goes all the way over to Lakeview on this, whereas anything east of the Cascades for our regional office purposes is covered out of Bend. I looked at that this morning, too, and said, oh, that's not the same.
I think you're right.
Okay.
Apologize for
no, it's fine.
By not reading the map right.
I had the same problem this morning.
We did not include
no, we'll get you a map of the water master offices.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, we do have a map. The state of Oregon, much the same, larger scale, but it does show our region boundaries as well as our water master district boundaries, and we'll get copies of that to you. Our water masters are field positions. They are the water regulators. They're the ones we turn to resolve conflicts of water use between users. So the majority of their time, they are out in the field. I understand there was a question yesterday about water master offices that may not be open all the time. And that is generally the case. Only about half of our water master offices have any kind of clerical support. And that clerical support is offered by local funds, county funds, or if we enter into contracts for measuring stream flows and that sort of thing, we come up with those dollars. At this time, I believe we only have two region offices and no water master offices that have state clerical support. The region offices we do keep open nearly all the time. There may be a few exceptions where we would have to close one.
How does the public know when those offices are open, if they need to go pick up a form or?
Mr. Chair, most of our offices do have telephone recording systems where we can record messages, and we try to convey information that way. We also try to post signs on the outside of the offices to advise customers when we are open. Local governments are faced with the same financial problems that state government is. We're already getting word from the counties that they're looking extremely hard on some of our locally funded positions. I believe that our assistant water master, our one assistant that we have in the Grants Pass office, he's worked for us for many, many years, has been notified by Josephine County that that position is being eliminated. We have also received similar indication that we may be losing positions in Baker County and also in Umatilla County. Our water masters and regions right now are working with the local budget committees, but it doesn't look like it's going to be a good experience this summer for us.
Mr. Baller, some of these positions you're losing because of lack of local support. Some of them, I would assume, you're losing because they're retiring, and just due to age. And some of them, I would guess, you're losing due to PERS, the people that are wanting to get out while they think they're in a better position for the state retirement system. Am I right on this?
Mr. Chair, as far as the state positions that are in the field that are currently vacant, that would be correct. The county positions, I have not seen that at this point. It's strictly a budgetary matter with local governments. But we have in the field, we do have one retirement that is a result of PERS. It was an individual who was eligible to retire and did retire. The duties of our field folks include regulation. They are a source of information by the public, a local source, so people aren't having to travel to Salem or to our region offices. They go to our local offices for water right application forms, for water right information, for advice, and to file complaints about water use. Our field offices collect surface water and groundwater data. That can be groundwater levels in wells, surface water flow measurements, as well as gathering data from precipitation gauges. We also conduct well inspections, and in our region offices, we have well inspectors. Those are other funded positions, and we target about 25% of the new wells constructed. We want to get out and actually do a physical inspection on those wells to assure that they're constructed to our minimum well construction standards. The purpose of that is to protect the groundwater resource from waste, contamination, or loss of artesian pressure. A lot of folks do contact us with issues regarding customer service issues as it relates to well construction, and we do not get involved in contracting issues or other customer service related issues. So our well inspection activity is resource protection. In addition, our field staff conduct the routine dam safety inspections. The high hazard dams, or the dams that fall under our dam safety requirements, we have looked at those and rated their hazard, I guess, as to life and property. With the highest hazard, we try to get out more frequently to inspect to assure that they are in proper maintenance condition. The lower hazard, we may only visit once every 5, 6, or 10 years. This is an area that has suffered with a reduction in staffing at the field level and an increased focus on processing water at transfers, in-stream leases, and other activities.
Have you resolved the issue? And you know, we heard about the task force this past year of people putting wells next to property lines too close to septic systems of their neighbors and neighborly conflicts that go on with those kind of situations.
Mr. Chair, I think Barry Norris would be a good one to ask on that. I know we are working on it. We have been meeting with Department of Environmental Quality to resolve that, and I believe that we are still working. And Barry can talk about that when he comes up. We, as I mentioned earlier, we also assist watershed councils. In addition to the folks that are out in the field, we also have Salem staff. We have liaisons in our office in the division that work very closely with our field offices on local planning issues. If a planning entity contacts us regarding new developments or sources of water to satisfy new development, our liaisons get involved. They also get involved if our field offices are finding groundwater issues, areas where groundwater supply is no longer adequate, and we use our liaisons to facilitate meetings, coordinate meetings, and call the various parties together. Our liaisons are also the ones that are processing in-stream leases, requests for allocation of conserved water, and review our water management conservation plans, which both municipalities and ag irrigation districts and ag users are submitting. We currently have approximately 42 water management plans that are being reviewed. That's an existing workload. We have, at this time, I think, about 6 in-stream leases that are being worked on. Last year, we set a goal for a review period of 30 days on an in-stream lease application. And our staff that were working on those really worked hard to see if we could process those in-stream lease requests in that 30-day window. At the end of the year last year, we looked at all of the leases that had been approved and the amount of time that it took, and the average process time turned out to be 35 days, so we were very close. We have about 15 requests for allocation of conserved water. Those do take a lot of time, and we're working on those. We are working, I think, some fairly slowly, and it is because of the amount of time it takes. In addition to the liaisons, we have the water rate transfer program. We process the leases in the Salem office for final processing and review. We have distributed the water rate transfer applications out into our field offices, and our field staff are really being a tremendous help in getting out the numbers that we have. Currently, we have a workload of about 750 water rate transfers that are awaiting a final decision. Last year, we processed 283, and we received, I believe, about 319 new applications. So even with our field staff working, we still fell behind. We're seeing a trend in water right transfer applications. Through the 90s, we were running in the 220, 250 applications filed each year. The last 3 years, we have seen a jump of nearly 100 transfers filed. We're up now in the neighborhood of 320 to 340 water rate transfer applications filed each year. I expect that that trend is going to continue. People are turning more and more to water rate transfers to meet their new or changing water demands. In addition, irrigation districts, some of you may recall House Bill 3111 of many years ago, but it was an irrigation district remapping program, and the majority of the irrigation districts have now completed that, and they have a good, accurate record of where their water use is, and now they are entering into transfers annually to either move places of use on an annual basis, or at the end of each year they are submitting applications to change the place of use on a permanent basis, and those numbers have been increasing steadily as well. You will notice under Field Services Division, Policy Package 81, 90, and 91. Those three are reduction packages, with 90 and 91 on page 57, sorry, and on 58. Package 90 reduces by one position our capability of conducting final proof surveys. That is a field position that is in place right now, and it would be proposed for elimination. Package 91 would reduce an assistant watermaster position in the Klamath, as well as a clerical position in our Northwest Region office. Recognizing the increased workload in transfers, water at transfers, packages 131 and 132 would be new staff. 131 includes two positions for addressing the water rate transfer processing issues, and that is the funding for those two positions would come from increased fees. And then 132 would be a restoration of a position, actually, that we lost earlier. And that position would be to work on water management conservation plans, allocations of conserved water, and other liaison-type activities. That one is also fee-based.
When did you lose that position?
Oh, 3 years ago. Mr. Chair, I believe it was 3 or 4 years ago, possibly.
And when you say you lost the funding or you lost the personnel?
Yes, it was both. There was a vacancy, and then we were unable to fill it. So
it's it's presently vacant?
It's presently not. It is not a current authorized position.
Right. Gotcha. Yes, Representative
Prager. Policy package 090 says eliminate 1-2 fireproof survey crews. How many is in a crew?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, originally there were two. We had a surveyor and a rodman. We still call it a crew, but with technology now, we have gone to one-person crews. And we do have two remaining, one in the southwest part of the state and then the other one in the John Day area that covers the eastern portion. So.
And then it says further down initially the package would eliminate field water rights specialist position located. And then you talk over here about doing this summer type thing at the Klamath Basin. Mm-hmm. Where there seems to be a lot of water type activity. I wonder how you prioritize where you're going to take these people away. Seem like they're leaving areas where probably that's one of the highest services that the economy needs to have served. And how do you relate the 10 positions lost? Are they all field positions, and did you take any out of Salem?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Representative Krieger, the Klamath position was a position authorized during the last legislative session as soon as we had the event of 9/11 and the starting into the declines in resources. We realized and we ended up with a freeze on filling new positions, that those positions were the ones that were going to be real tough to maintain. That position has been empty since it's been authorized, so it would be back up on the list. The other
In package 90, there are two positions, and one of those is in Salem.
Right, and that's a Salem position that has also been vacant. We use the vacancy savings to manage our way through the special session reductions, and now they're being proposed for elimination. Right, and we've tried to reprogram things as well as we can within the department to try to cover that, but we've got a. As Tom indicated, Salem position, a position down in Grants Pass, and then a position that had never been filled but was authorized down in Klamath. The three that you're looking at there.
The clerical position also, so there are actually four, but the clerical position is also in Salem.
Is
it safe to say that with better communications with computers and networking and with GPS systems that you can reduce staff and get the same workload done?
Mr. Chair, we've been trying to get the workload done faced with reduced staff. The reason we're able to accomplish what we are able to currently is because of technology, because of our data center, our water right information that is up on computer, the maps that are up on computer. It used to be we would have customers come in and we would have to sit down, go through notebooks of paper, trying to find the water right that they were interested in, trying to find the map, interpret, and so on. Now customers have access. We've tried to put in customer service computer terminals in quite a few of our field offices as well as our Salem office. And the customers who do come in for that information are able to do the same kind of research on their own. Also, it used to be the water masters would spend all winter in the office hand drawing distribution maps, going through files and generating distribution lists. of the various users, water rate information, and that sort of thing by hand. Now we can get that same information from the computer. The maps are upgraded on a fairly regular basis, so our water masters are no longer doing that kind of activity. Instead, they're inspecting dams and assisting with processing water right transfers and other activities of that nature. But yeah, we have gotten a lot smarter with what we have to work with. We have to.
Is that the end of your presentation?
I don't have anything else.
Any questions? Wayne, do we have any questions? We're kind of being left alone.
Good segue into our technical services division.
Maybe one, Chair. If you eliminate the water master, that you're going to do in Coos County, you're still going to have one there. But you're
he was just kidding.
He was just kidding. What I'm saying is I will be calling you personally if I need service.
We are currently recruiting for that position to fill it. The individual who was in that position,
you're putting a lot of
never asked the question. We are.
He almost lost two votes in
this. We are. You'll see... we discussed vacancies, and it's one that's being actively recruited.
Paul, before you move on, we asked the question yesterday about future or potential needs of water, and I think you said you'd have Mr. Bailey speak to that today.
The water availability and long-term water supply, we'll have Barry Norris will cover some of that, and then I'll talk some on the what's going on with, or Adam Sussman will talk on long-term water supply efforts. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going down our checklist here. I've got through five finished up, and we'll move into number six right now.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Barry Norris, and I'm administrator of the Technical Services Division. We have 37 positions in the Technical Services Division. We're divided into, I should say that we start on in tab 3, page 67. We have four sections within the Technical Services Division, plus a dam safety program, and if it's all right with you, I'll just run down through those different program areas and explain a little bit about each one, and then also at the same time try to answer some of the questions that you asked yesterday. The dam safety program is comprised of one dam safety coordinator, and then I give it some of my time as well. We do field inspections, special inspections, work with the field inspectors, as Tom Paul mentioned to you a little bit ago. They do the routine inspections. We'll do a lot of the special inspections, construction inspections. If the field inspectors find a problem, well, we'll go out and we'll take a look at it and assess that problem and then decide what needs to be done. We keep an inventory of all of the dams in Oregon that are under the jurisdiction of a dam safety program. Those dams have to impound both 9.2 acre feet or more, and they have to be 10 feet or more in height for them to be under the jurisdiction of the dam safety program. We have about 1,300 of those in the state.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. For other littler dams, how's the jurisdiction for those work, just to distinguish your program from local programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, they still need a water right, typically, as the big ones do. But as far as the dam safety program's concerned, it's just up to the owners, operators of those structures, to build them so that they don't present a hazard to somebody. So they're pretty much on their own.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Are they inspected at the local level for integrity? Is there any enforcement for smaller dams to assure that they're not deteriorating if they're earthen structures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, if we get a call and we have the time, we'll go out and we'll take a look at them, and we'll offer suggestions and so forth, and that happens quite a bit, actually. But as far as a mandatory inspection program, the only county I know of that has that type of a program, I believe, is Washington County.
Thank you. I haven't done this budget before, and I apologize for some of the basic questions.
And you provide education as to how to build the dams, clear the ground, and lock the base of the dam and that type of thing?
Mr. Chair, we do. We have a handout that we provide to people that are thinking about building these things, and we show them a typical configuration for a spillway and how to slope them and the top width and those kinds of general plans for them. Since 1999, we have issued over 63 permits for construction on dams that are over 50 acre feet of water. We review, so you can see, we review about 15 sets of plans a year. Some of the larger ones that we've been participated in from a dam safety point of view and a water right point of view over the last few years have been the raising of Barney Reservoir, the new construction of McGuire Reservoir for the city of McMinnville, and the reconstruction of Haskins Reservoir also for the city of McMinnville. Those are some of the larger projects, and also Upper Pony Creek, as I'm sure you're aware of. Reconstruction of that. That was a brand new structure immediately adjacent to the old structure. We also, with the House Bill 2366, we've been taking a look at how we would implement that if it's passed through the legislature and signed. That is the Senate Bill 93 proposal for doing a storage inventory statewide. Over the years, we've put a lot of material together that we have about existing sites that have been reviewed and investigated. We have hundreds of those sites on inventory. The problem is we don't know which of those sites may have already the structure has been built, which of those sites they may have been duplicated and just called different names and different sizes, how many of them have been looked at and simply just put to the side because technically they weren't feasible. I have, I think, 7 volumes of geotechnical reports that have been done over the years by different federal agencies to look at different sites under programs that they had years past for helping construct small reservoirs for irrigation and stock and so forth. Different federal agencies, local governments have inventories that they've performed over the years. Somebody needs to take some time and go through and do quality assurance on all of those, root out all of the different inventories and sources of information that are available around the state. It's not a very easy task. You can call the same office and talk to one person one time and find out that they don't know of anything that's available. And then you might call and get somebody else that knows that there is something available. So it isn't a matter of just writing a letter and or making a phone call and getting all this put together. It's a matter of talking to the right people, visiting the offices, going through files, putting everything together, doing quality assurance on that so that we get the one file on each proposed site and get that information all up and readily available for people to use. So it's a fairly large task, and that's why we have a fiscal impact attached to it, although I'm not any under illusions that we might get general fund for it. So we, as our director said yesterday, maybe if you elect not to provide the general fund, why we could maybe have fund limitation and try to find funding for that.
How do you share that information, or how is it used for, as one example I'm thinking of is land use planning. I mean, it's one thing to have it on somebody's map. It's another thing that the local governments are able to protect those sites, or at least be aware that there is a valid potential site there.
Mr. Chair, you make a good point. I haven't given that a lot of thought, other than we do have a pretty good website where we can go in to it and click and point on wells and gauging stations and other things that are on inventory with our department. I anticipated making this the approach that we'd take on the dam sites, where you could click on it and see all the information that would be available. Perhaps we need some coordination also with the county planners to make them aware that this site would be available once it's developed, and then when they're anticipating land use changes, they could look at the site and see what dam sites have been identified.
Or to make your job easier, maybe work with DLCD and make them responsible to get that information down to counties.
Yes, sir, that's a good idea. In addition to that approach for future supplies, Senate Bill 93 or House Bill, the program, the House Bill 2366, we also think that aquifer storage and recovery and aquifer recharge are of high potential. we have proposed in the past programs to take a look at do a statewide inventory of the potential for those kinds of sites. We've even gone through and done a very cursory look at the state and water availability, and we produced a pamphlet about a year ago that gives some preliminary indications of the potential for aquifer storage and recovery and aquifer recharge. Currently, there are six water districts or municipalities that are investigating aquifer storage and recovery. They're two different programs. Aquifer recharge requires a DEQ permit and a permit from us as well to take the water and store water in the ground, in the groundwater aquifer. Aquifer storage and recovery is a program that the legislation was passed several sessions ago that gets pre-approval under the DEQ requirements as long as the water is injected into the ground, has quality consistent with drinking water standards. Why the only permit that's required is from the Water Resources Department. So they're two different programs, but they're kind of the same idea, storing water in ground. Anyway, the six entities that are currently investigating this include Pendleton, the City of Salem, Portland, Tualatin Valley Water District, and the City of Beaverton as one, Clackamas River Water District, and the City of Tigard. So that's an active program that's going on, and people are giving that a lot of a good look for future water supplies. In addition, we have two aquifer recharge sites, new ones that are being investigated, Echo Meadows, and then an individual, a farmer up in the Umatilla Basin.
I apologize for keep stepping back with you. But as we look at potential sites for additional water resources, is someone also programming growth areas and potential needs and bringing those together so we know whether we're on a time frame that's workable or whether we're heading for a train wreck? Or I'm sure not every some communities probably have planned ahead for additional capacity for 10, 15, 20 years, and others probably are way short.
Mr. Chair, as you indicated, it's kind of a mixed bag. We've got about 130 communities, though, that are right now going through water management conservation planning efforts related to permit extensions. So for those, they're trying to project their water demands on both a long term, and then I believe under their land use planning requirements, they have to show that they've got a secure water supply for at least the next 20 years. So we're working with those communities. The ones that aren't in that process, we know they've got a lot of other local planning efforts that don't trigger us. We think for the most part the communities are anticipating those needs. Some of the smaller communities are having trouble. We're working with the League of Oregon Cities on a model plan, and we want to get that kind of information out to them so they can develop these things and have more of a checklist approach, if you will, than have to hire out to major consulting firms for them.
What about the larger users, Metro, Salem area, Eugene area? Are they in pretty good shape, or are they coming down on crunch time?
Well, Mr. Chair, again, they seem to be in pretty good shape. They've got a lot of flexibility. The bigger the systems are, they've got some more flexibility. Where we're hearing, and we're going over Friday to talk with municipal providers over in the Bend area, they're starting to run up against their limits of their existing water rights, and we're working with them on developing new groundwater over there. Maybe you've seen some articles here recently in the newspaper about the Metro discussion of regionalizing the water system up in that area, and just to try to give themselves some more flexibility. Wilsonville, of course, was one of the larger communities that was up against the limits of their permits. They were on groundwater. They addressed that by developing a treatment plant and going to Willamette River water, and that seems to have been real successful for them.
So they're using Salem's wastewater?
They're using Willamette River water, sir.
I remember that conversation last year with Representative Krieger.
Chair Mesley. Paul, Jim Brown, who's now the Natural Resource Advisor, prior state forester, was sued. Pacific Rivers Council, one of them, regarding his notification to a forest operation if it affected coho could constitute a take under the 4D rule. And of course, when I talked to them a couple of weeks ago, I said, well, what would happen if someone would sue you the same way on each and every permit that you did, for instance, Bull Run of Portland, because of the amount of water they take and the consequence of that? I mean, that could be a Pandora's box like I can't imagine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, we try to use what we call our Division 33 process, where we consult with ODF&W on new permits, and we've got some review of ESA issues related to extensions as well. It is a concern. Generally, operations under existing permits, you'd have to pretty much fall under a Section 9 take. And up in the Walla Walla, in the northeast corner of the state, where we had dry riverbeds, where we had fish rescues that occurred historically, the districts got together and did a voluntary bypass plan to avoid a take there. Klamath, it was a Section 7 consultation that caught them in that trigger. But yeah, it is a concern of ours. It's one that's being actively litigated around the West. When do you get to bring this question of compliance with the Endangered Species Act into the process on both existing and new permits? But it's one that our attorneys kind of continue to caution us on, and to my knowledge, we have not been sued similar to in the past. I know it hasn't occurred in the 2.5 years I've been there.
Chair, that process and the mindset behind doing that, its potential for others is kind of staggering. What it could mean, it's just simply how mischievous does any particular group want to come to do that. They could file on every one of them. So I just want to make sure people understood that there is a real out there.
Right, and of course we try to use our Oregon Plan measures and our activities in terms of flow restoration, in-stream leasing, and so forth to show that we really are running a balanced program. Interestingly, the drought year of 2001 in the Rogue Basin, the storage capability that we had in Lost Creek Reservoir was what allowed us to avoid a fish kill down in the lower Rogue that probably would have been of the magnitude of what we saw down the Klamath, because we had that storage capability there and we were able to time the releases of water out of storage to moderate the temperature standards down there. A good example of where stored water benefits fish as well.
Representative, what you're referring to is that once there's a court case and develops precedence, it could apply across to all of our permitting agencies.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mr. Chair. And there's been court cases in other states. I know that the state of Massachusetts had a court case involving their permits that they were given to lobster fishermen and how these the lobster traps were tangling up some endangered whale species. Yeah.
Paul, how are we doing? I don't know where
we're. We're moving okay. We'll get through Barry here, and then we'll finish up with me, and we're done.
Oh,
finish up with me and Bruce.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Barry Norris again. The first program after dam safety I'll speak to is our water management and hydrographics program. We run about 200 gauging stations, surface water gauging stations statewide. Our hydrographics program are the people that receive the raw data, the stage data, that is the elevation of the water surface in electronic form from the gauging stations, and convert that to flow. They do that and make the data there available over the website for people to use in all kinds of activities, including designing bridges, designing roads, water supply, just determining what the average flows, the medium flows, the high flows, the low flows. That's the kind of data. That is the data that's needed anytime anybody's looking at the flows in surface water bodies statewide. They also tabulate our well net information that we get from our field inspectors, our field personnel, and put it up onto our website and that's also accessible by the public or anybody else that wants it and used for whatever reason they need it.
Mr. Norse, I have two questions. Do you utilize the field staff that's right around the state in helping to gather your information? And the second part of the question would be, are there federal agencies that also gather snowpack and stream flows, and how do you coordinate with them? Is there duplication? That's where I'm going.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, the field staff are the ones that actually gather the information. Our hydrographic section are the ones that do the quality assurance on it and reduce it into a usable format for the users and get it up on the website. The field folks get the raw data. Where it's surface water data, they'll get the gauge height, the elevation of the data. And then the Salem folks convert it to the flow data. And it's the same process for the groundwater data.
So when we're talking field staff, you're talking about Mr. Paul's field staff that works with your department?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We sort of have program control, I guess you'd call it, with the hydrographic section, but Mr. Paul has hydrographers and a hydrographer in each one of the region offices that are responsible for gathering the data. There are some federal agencies, well, primarily the USGS, that gathers data. We have had over the years an extensive cooperative program with them. They have a number of gauging stations. Our gauging stations are at locations where we need additional data. The state needs the data either to monitor diversions or raw data that we need in our water availability analysis or our flood frequency analysis of the different programs. We coordinate very closely with them. We have a lot of cooperation with them. We have some formal cooperative agreements. The snowpack data, of course, is the NRCS. We have a technical group that meets quite often, that includes the NRCS snow, Stan Fox from the Snow Survey, USGS, that is responsible for their surface water monitoring program. We have the state climatologist that sits in on that. We have the person from the state forestry and the National Weather Service. And so we do a lot of coordination and make sure that we know all the data that's collected and we use each other's data. That program is also responsible for our water use reporting program, which gets public data from public entities statewide, and our surface water hydrology program or hydrologic investigations. You asked a question yesterday about water availability. I brought some maps with me today. Should I, with your permission, I'll stand up and speak from over here and show them to you.
We've got in our report back to you from yesterday, right after the map on the adjudicated areas, there's a commission agenda item from our last commission meeting on long-term water supply, and in that it's a little three-page discussion. It's got some of that data that Barry was talking about in terms of new projects, who's doing what with new storage projects. And then we've got some of these large-scale water availability maps that you asked, so that's what Barry will be going to now.
Mr. Chair, this is a map of available stream flow by month. So there are 12 pictures of the state of Oregon, and they're color-coded for the amount of water that's available for appropriation surface water supply by month. So the brown color is for no water available for appropriation. This is on an 80% exceedance. So we've done this statewide on an 80% exceedence. We've taken an 80% natural flow. We've subtracted from that consumptive use, and then we've subtracted from it in-stream water rights or scenic waterways, and that's what's left over. Now, there was a question asked yesterday about the amount of water that might be available should we not include the in-stream water rights.
Well, Barry's grabbing that. What we gave you in this was the August. That's often the most limiting month, so you can kind of see the August available stream flow.
That's right, Mr. Chair. As Paul pointed out, it would be the same as the month of August that's shown on this 12-month chart. So what you have is an 8.5 by 11 with the month of August. You'll see at the top available stream flow on an 80% exceedance. Now, we contrast that with expected stream flow on an 80% exceedance. expected. We're calling it expected because we have not subtracted out of the equation the in-stream water rights, but the water would still be there. So it would be available for somebody that has a water right to appropriate, I suppose, if we didn't have in-stream water rights, or somebody to appropriate a new water right. So that's the difference, and you'll see in your chart, or in your packet, the month of August again, that you can contrast the 2 months of August, one for expected and one for water availability.
Now that even applies as groundwater, doesn't it? To groundwater if it's in a drainage system that is short water?
Mr. Chair, no, this does not include groundwater. It would include any groundwater, any contributions from groundwater, if that's what you're getting at, such as springs or a gaining reach of stream after it leaves the ground and becomes surface water. But it does not portray any groundwater availability for wells, something like that.
Okay, but let me be clear on this, because the experience I've had is on my home site, I live on a ridge, and on one side of the ridge I wanted to drill a well for a backup water supply, and I was told I could not because that drainage was limited because of the salmon listings. The other side of the ridge was not, but it would be fine to drill a well over there. So I'm probably confusing with the presentation you're giving.
No, sir, I was confused. I didn't understand what you're getting at. Mr. Chair, we go through what's called a Division 9 review for new applications for water rights, and it's for groundwater rights. And where we find that there's a hydraulic connection, that is, the groundwater is supplying a surface water body, then we take a look at, then the application people, the groundwater people, determine that. And then they tell our application people in water rights whether or not there's a hydraulic connection and a potential for substantial interference. In other words, there's a potential that it could harm a surface water user. Then the water rights people take a look at water availability. And if the surface water body that's interacting, the hydraulic connection with the groundwater body, has no water available, then we would deny the right, because by taking the groundwater, it would injure a surface water user.
And that includes in-stream?
Yes, sir. Includes in-stream. We take a look at water availability. That includes the consumptive use subtracted, as well as the in-stream water rights. And the last chart that you were talking about yesterday is a chart that we would use when we're evaluating an application for storage. It's a guideline rather than a hard, fast rule. We look at it on a 50% exceedance basis. And you have in your packet one of them for the month of, I've forgotten now.
February
and April, as I recall.
Right.
The reason we gave you those 2 months, or those two different months, is because it shows the contrast between snowpack-dominated basins and rainfall runoff-dominated basins. You can see that in April it opens up a lot more on the east side, where you get the runoff. And this again are the 12 months of the year, and it's water that would be available for storage. And again, on a guideline of a 50% exceedance.
This is a topic of discussion around the West. What's happening with perhaps this question of global warming, if you will, or an increasing warming trend in systems that are snowpack dominated? You can see we really rely on snowpack as a way to store water on the east side and in the Cascade side. The coastal range, it's more a rainfall-dominated area. And while we may have the same precip with a warmer climate, we'll have a real loss of that snowpack. I think Barry and I were at a meeting, and they were talking about how a 4 or 5 degree increase in the average temperature over the winter can result in about a one-third loss in the amount of snow, particularly at the lower elevations. And so that's where, if we start to see those long-term trends, we don't have the storage capacity to capture
that water when it's running off. Right now we rely on the snow to lock that in, and so that's one of the things that we're looking at from a long-term trend standpoint.
So, Paul, help me out here. My perception has been that the potential for in-stream storage is gone, probably forever. Am I hearing you say that there is? If the demand is great enough and they can afford it, there is still potential for in-stream storage?
Mr. Chair, we'll call that kind of in-channel storage structures. I think some of the ones that we're seeing are raising the height of existing in-channel storage structures. That certainly is still available. I think with appropriate passage, new structures are certainly available. People do look at the off-channel opportunities because it may be cheaper than providing the fish passage around an in-channel structure. But I don't know, Barry, what do we see? A lot of these smaller reservoirs are obviously going to be in-channel for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we think certainly one of the potentials, one of the things we'd want to include in our inventory, is the opportunity to raise the height on existing structures.
Mr. Chair, another program area in our technical service division is our groundwater section. They do application review, take a look, as I described, on a Division 9 review for new applications and determine whether or not there's hydraulic connection. They investigate interference complaints among existing groundwater users and service water and groundwater users. We have regulated groundwater in favor of service water in this state. They have special project areas where new subdivisions may go in an area and they're short of water supply, and we need to investigate and come to some kind of an agreement where people can continue to get the water they need. We manage our existing classified and critical groundwater areas that have been established around the state, and we do major basin investigations. As you probably know, we've just completed the Deschutes Basin. We're nearly complete with an investigation of the alluvial aquifer and the Willamette Basin, and we're about two-thirds done with an investigation in the Klamath Basin. These are major investigations that are cooperative with the USGS. We supply people and some of the funding. They supply people and half the funding, and then we do the investigation. In the Klamath, we've been able to get some dollars from the Bureau of Reclamation to support that as well. Another program area in our division is our information technology section. We're very proud of our information technology section. As Paul mentioned in his presentation on field services, that's been the reason we've been able to keep up with a lot of the workload, even though we've been losing staff over the years. We've done something, I think, a little bit different in our department. About 12 years ago, we integrated very closely our information technology group with the program areas. And so we did not wind up with a situation of information technology dictating to people how the programs would operate. Rather, in reverse, we had program people telling information technology what it is they needed and how they needed that to do their programs. It's worked very well. If you've had an opportunity to look at our website, we're very proud of that. We have a lot of data up there and a lot of tools available for people to use to get the information they need, and it was really driven by our program areas who need that information as well. The information technology section has a data entry section or a data entry group. They have a user support person. They have a network support person. And we have a GIS section. For a long time, GIS technology was fairly new, and it was looked at as a kind of a different way of portraying data. Anymore with our agency, it's our main database for almost all of our data that we have, especially in surface water and groundwater data, numerical type data. We use it to do analysis. We've used it to develop our water availability model. We're using it to develop a flood frequency model for the state, and so on. And I should say, lately in our information technology group, security has been occupying a lot of our time, making sure that the website is secure and that people can't get in there and do harm to us and also get into the state network and do harm. The last section to talk about in our division is enforcement and well construction. We're responsible for licensing well constructors statewide and overseeing that program. There are about 760 licensed well constructors statewide. About half of those are active. We now have a new continuing education program in place that was part of some legislation passed last session. We have a person in this section that's responsible for leading the well inspection program statewide. He provides training and technical assistance to the well inspectors that are located in the region offices, and that person is responsible also for providing special standards for well constructors when they run into a situation and our standard rules don't fit the situation. Our enforcement and well construction program also includes responsibility for enforcement actions where there's a forfeiture of a water right, where there are well construction problems, or there are water right regulation that's been forwarded on for formal enforcement from the field. The last thing I'll address, Mr. Chair, is a question you asked about the well siting issue that we're working on with DEQ. And we think we've made a lot of progress, or we know we've made a lot of progress in that area. We're at the point where we're putting the final touches on a memorandum of agreement. And I think the main point of that agreement between the two agencies is that DEQ will recognize our special standards as a pre-approved variance under their program. So if we have a well that's constructed under special standards, that is constructed in a manner that provides for assurance against contamination from a septic system or a drain field, then they'll recognize that, and then they won't require a property owner to go through their extensive variance process. In other words, we'll have a pre-approval under certain circumstances. So there are other things that go along with that, of course, but that is I think that's a major point.
How do you communicate between the departments? Do they notify you of all requests for septic systems, and do they have records of where all the wells are?
Mr. Chair, they... We haven't set up a communication process where we would monitor where all the septic systems are and they would monitor where all our wells are. This is going to be written into rules for the people installing septic systems and rules for our well constructors. They're going to have to follow with. Right now, there's a requirement that the drain fields and the septic and the wells be a minimum of 100 feet apart, or a well can be constructed no closer than 100 feet to a property line and a drain field no closer than 10 feet to a property line for the 100 feet. Well constructor is going to be required to get a special standard if they go closer than that. And they're also, of course, going to have to look and see. They do look and try to find out where the drain fields are. And so it's on the constructors of those facilities to determine whether or not there's a problem. And if there is a problem, why then they get back with the DEQ or with the Water Resource Department and figure out how to resolve that problem.
Okay. Any questions, committee?
Move to administrative services then.
Thank you.
While Bruce is coming up here, I did some quick tallies on the positions that we've lost both through the special sessions and that would be eliminated under the governor's balanced budget. We're approximately half of our positions are located in Salem, half in the field. Under the governor's balanced budget, we lose 4 positions in Salem, 2 out in the field. Under the special sessions, we had about 1.7 positions lost out in the field. So we're not we're absorbing those reductions proportionally between Salem and the field.
And Paul, I believe tomorrow you're going to give us the percentage reductions, and you'll also include what that would mean to your staffing levels.
Right. We've got the staffing levels in there. Yeah. And I'm looking at this chart I've got here. We don't have it Salem versus field, but we'll get that information. So we've got that for you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Moyer with the department. here to talk about the administrative services section. As with most state agencies, the administrative services component of the agency provides those central type services related to budgeting, accounting, human resources, support services, facilities, and so on. With the Water Resources Department, we have, including the loan program, about 13.5 FTE that's devoted to those central activities. Basically, there's four different sections to the division. One is the human resources section. That includes two FTE. Excuse me, we're at page 77. I'm sorry. We have two FTE that are dedicated to the human resources section. With reductions taken in the last budgetary cycle, these employees are also responsible for any coordination of training that takes place. We lost resources related to central training last time around. We also have about 2.5 FTE that's dedicated to support services. These are services that are provided to the whole agency in terms of reception responsibilities, ordering of supplies, mail room, copy room support, agency inventory, and so on. The fiscal services section includes 6 FTE. One fiscal manager and five other employees. These people provide all of the accounting, payroll, purchasing, and contract services for the agency. The business services section, which has the equivalent of about one FTE, takes care of the budget preparation, telecommunications, and facilities management. The total budget for general fund budget for the division is about $3 million. Seems fairly excessive for the number of FTE, but included in that $3 million is about $1.2 million for all of the Salem rents. We don't do a cost allocation to each of the divisions, so all of the rent is included in the administrative services budget, as is the central government service charges, which amounts to another $400,000. So that kind of inflates what the budget of administrative services looks like.
If I could stop you right there. I became aware this morning, and I don't know if it applies to your budget or not, but there's been an additional charge received recently. Did that happen to the Water Resources Department? From DAS.
Or what? Increased rent? Or?
Well, I'm not sure what a maintenance or the whole...
You might talk about the rent, the standard rent increase.
Right. I'm not sure what you're relating to, Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure either. I'm fishing, but...
Yeah. The facilities division at DAS has apparently notified some agencies that the maintenance costs that they provide, such as janitorial services, have costed more than they had expected when the budgets were originally done. And so some agencies have received notification that those costs will go up. However, my understanding, and I may be wrong at this point, but earlier we were going to take a look at that and see if that was actually going to go forward or not.
If I understand, there was a charge for the rest of this biennium as well as a ramp up for the next biennium.
Mr. Chair, yes. Apparently, there's a provision that DAS facilities can go back retroactively and true up the costs for these services towards the end of the current biennium, and then that, of course, would also roll forward into the next biennium.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's sort of perplexing, and while it probably is not an appropriate subject for this hearing right now, I would hope that our Ways and Means colleagues might raise that as a question, because for the ability to have DAS true up, has a ripple effect back on agency budgets, and I think when it comes as a shock out of the blue, it makes budgeting integrity on the part of the subject agencies impossible.
Very good, Representative Johnson. And that's exactly right. Not only for the rest of this mania, but now they're getting charged or told they're going to have to increase their budget for the coming mania, right as we're into the hearings and in the process. So the timing is not good, I don't think.
There's also something about leading by example. And I think at a time of austerity, when we're asking agencies to tighten their belts, I maybe would take exception. I need to know a little bit more before I can get too fuzzed up about it, but it's something I'd like us to explore.
Representative Traeger.
If I might, the DAS analyst is aware of this, and it is being investigated. Okay. So,
thank you.
Yeah. And I'm going to be raising this issue with every budget we see from here on out just to see what the impact is.
Well, Mr. Chair, excuse me.
Let me get Representative Traeger first.
Just quick, I think they already have got Representative Johnson buzzed up, I think is the word she used. The other thing is...
I was motivated by your tie.
Yeah. Oh. If you can't depend on DAS to know what projected costs are for advising us on certain things, I mean, who are we going to go to?
Good point.
Mr. Chair, to your question, though, the Water Resources Department hasn't been notified that there's been any change in facilities costs. But we are hoping that we can be confident of the rates that are being assessed for this coming biennium. Again, the Administrative Services General Fund budget may look inflated because we do, again, pay for all central supplies and communications, and postage is included in our budget for the whole agency. The Administrative Services budget in package 081, 091, and 092 reflect the general fund reductions for the division. It does include significant reductions in terms of other rents other than the Salem rents. We pay for storage facilities and so on, so we've taken a reduction in that. We've also taken action to fund shift a half-time position from general fund to other funds, the source of those funds are a contract with OWEB. The department provides administrative support for OWEBs in terms of accounting and budgeting, not so much budgeting, but human resources and some support services. Let's see. We have one policy package that proposes to increase the general fund of the agency and the division. That's package 110 on page 78. That's relative to the agency's relocation to the North Mall office building. This package requests an increase in the uniform rents that DAS charges the agency for approximately 8,500 additional square feet. Of that 8,500 square feet, we calculate that we would have about 70% of that, or about 6,000 square feet, available for actual office space. There's usually about a 30% common space loss in this particular new building. And this package just covers the actual rent increase for the 0305 biennium. It does not include any expenses related to the physical relocation. We expect to be able to, or we're planning to be able to facilitate that relocation within current resources of this biennium. So with that.
Okay, I think, Mr. Moyer, I just figured out why you haven't been notified. You're moving out of your old building into the new one, and it's in the charge. You just can't find it.
Okay. Well, one point, Mr. Chair, you did ask yesterday, inquired about what the use of the Commerce Building was going, or what the plans were for the Commerce Building after we relocate. And talking with facilities today, they indicate they intend to begin renovation of that building immediately after we vacate. There's a projected project schedule of about a year to a year and a few months, and it's programmed that Elements of Justice will be moving into that building.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Paul, you have 6 minutes.
I've got 6 minutes?
6 minutes and tomorrow.
That's fine. I'll just cover real quickly then the director's office, which is on page 83 in your book. The director's office obviously is the entity that attempts to provide oversight and coordination of the programs. We do policy, legislative, legal coordination, interagency coordination, the government-to-government negotiations, and I would like to report that we had a real success in that in terms of completing the negotiation with the Warm Springs tribe on their reserve right in the Deschutes Basin. About a 12-year process that we finally have gotten wrapped up. We also, of course, provide the planning, scheduling support to the Water Resource Commission. Trying to lead by example, all our program packages are program reductions. We've got 7 positions, myself, the deputy director, the support for the commission, support for the deputy director and myself, and then 3 policy positions, all of whom do outstanding jobs. And I'm glad I don't have them on hourly wage because I'd be paying a lot of overtime for them. With that, I wanted to cover the things that were on my list that you wanted us to get to, and I'm going to go down to number 8, the ballot measure 66 related activities, we've got a memo in here that describes what we've identified within our kind of integrated program that supports the Oregon plan. Are you able to find it? I think it'd be right after the maps, right? Yeah, ballot measure 66 related activities. We currently estimate that we've got about 7.5 FTEs and funded with about $1.2 million in general fund that are focused in support of the Oregon plan. Now, again, this isn't 7.5 people. I've got people doing bits and pieces of this work around the state, some of them more than others, but that's what we've come up with as we allocate things out, 7.5 FTEs, $1.2 million. That's the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds. We also have identified opportunities if there are additional resources made available, primarily, I think, under the federal funds. And there we had 2 different proposals that we've submitted through the governor's office, and that was 5 FTE and $720,000 to work on processing in-stream leases, transfers, facilitate the CREP program, and looking at other flow restoration activities. And then we had a project related to processing our hydrographic records, and that we had an estimated cost of $70,000. These were not in the governor's it wasn't part of the agency request or in the governor's balanced budget. The current activities, of course, are in the incorporated within the governor's balanced budget right now, funded out of general fund.
So these would not help us with the general fund problem, but they would be help you get some projects done?
Yeah, if we could get to into the federal fund for those. The current ones, current activities, we currently are getting $1.2 million in general fund that we think, you know, if there's a Measure 66 money available, would be eligible for that. Scenic waterway activities, we also were asked to look at, are there some things that we're doing that might relate to the Measure 66 program run by the Parks and Recreation Department. We do a lot of work to try to protect the scenic waterway flows, groundwater studies, our reviews of water right applications to ensure that we're not impacting them. The entire effort that we've got in the Deschutes Basin in terms of our mitigation program is related to both the scenic waterway and the in-stream water right. And then, of course, we do a lot of work with with the reservoir managing agencies, the Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, and others to try to coordinate releases and management of the storage in order to support both flat water and river-based recreation. We've got some maps attached here that show the in-stream water rights, the scenic waterway system, and then what we call the last one, the colored map, is our stream flow restoration priorities. And these are basins where we have worked with ODF&W to identify where there's both we'd have the best chance of getting water available for flow restoration and where it would get the biggest bang for the buck in terms of biological needs. And you can kind of see both where we've got priorities and where we haven't ranked things yet. But that just gives you an idea of that kind of activity that we do, both related to the Oregon Plan for salmon and watersheds, as well as related to park and recreation activities. And then the other...
Paul, let me stop there.
Okay.
Yes, I think it would be helpful if you could develop more information related to the parks side of...
Okay.
66. Whether we can use it or not, I don't know, but
right.
It would be good to have that information
okay.
available.
Happy to.
And also, on the current activities, you're not projecting that any of the federal funds could be used for that?
Chair Messley, we didn't propose any of the federal funds in the governor's balanced budget, so what we were asked was to identify things that weren't included in the agency request or weren't included in the balanced budget, and these are the ones that we identified then in that other area. Right. And then there were two other things that I was asked to kind of respond to. I'll jump down to number 10 on my list here. And that's the Klamath Basin Economic Evaluation. We were talking yesterday about what's the impact of land idling, what's the impact of regulatory...
Paul, we are out of time.
Okay.
I know some of us have other appointments. Could we pick up on this tomorrow?
We'll hit that first thing tomorrow, and then we'll move into the rest of it.
Okay.
Sounds good. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. With that, we'll adjourn the public hearing, close the public hearing, and the committee meeting.
Thank you.